Oh, that's right. How you doing this afternoon? Hey, I am Ann Eller, and it is time for Meet Me at the Diner. And today we have with us my very special honor to have Christopher Thomas. He is director of the Benjamin E. Mays Historical Preservation Site right over there on the Gleams property. How you doing today, Chris?
I'm doing great, Ann. How are you?
Very good. Well, we've just been talking how a person from California ends up back in Greenwood and, looks at California the way it is out there. What are you thinking now that you've been here, what, 11 years?
11 years, 11 years. There certainly are very differing cultural ideas in both states, and certainly here being Greenwood, being in more the rural part of South Carolina, the culture is very different. People think differently. They view a lot of things, particularly social issues, very differently, and so it's like two different worlds, really.
Yeah. Would you want to go back to California now?
I lived there for 40 years of my first 40 years of my life, primarily, and so I think I would probably be able to adjust. I was always probably a more conservative thinking person living in California, even when I was there before. So, I don't think the way people think and act and look at the world in California is not much different then than it would be now. So I probably could go back. I have no plans on going back, but I probably could. Yeah.
You like it here?
I do. I always did. Like I said, my father and grandparents and aunts and uncles and everyone was here. And so I came here every summer of my life when I was a boy. In those days, of course, my dad was a military officer. And so we could hop on a little skipper anytime we wanted to. And, my dad, mom or dad would fly us here, and they'd go back, and we'd stay all summer. It's like being home to me, because I always looked at it as home, and I probably have more family members here than anywhere. When we moved here, my oldest two boys were early teenagers, and I told them, if you're thinking about dating someone, you need to ask some questions, because we're related to half the town. And it took them a while to realize that Dad was telling the truth, and so
that also meant they couldn't hide very well here, didn't it? Too?
That is true. That is very true.
So how did you end up being the director over there at the Mays Center?
So I met Loy Sarton, who was the curator that cured the site shortly after it was cured, and he and I got into a lengthy conversation about my love for history and African-American history. It was my major as an undergraduate student, and he said, why don't you come do some tours? And so I started coming over there and helping him out when he couldn't be there, or he had a large group or something, and I probably did that for about 4.5 years, and then Loy was going to retire. And he was, and I appreciate him for that, because, that was like his child. He it was his baby for many, many years. Loy Sarton meant everything to the May site. There would not be a May site probably if there wasn't for Loy. And the fact that he had enough respect for me and trust for me to sort of turn over his baby to me, meant a lot to me, and it still does. And so when he was retiring, Dr. Patton initially interviewed me, but then Dr. Patton retired. And so when Shauna came on, she actually hired me shortly after her coming on, and I've been there almost 2 years now.
Yeah. And, there's been some really nice things happening over there at the Mays Center. The statue that was dedicated, what was it, last November?
November the 4th.
That's right. Yeah. Was quite a big deal.
It really was. It was a phenomenal weekend of events. I still get cards and calls from people that were involved with the event, and people that couldn't come. I received a call today from a lady named Joy Bennett, and Joy is the daughter of Dr. Lerone Bennett, who was a 49 graduate of Morehouse. He was in that second wave of early admission students that came to Morehouse as 14 and 15-year-olds, a year behind King. Dr. Bennett went on to be the editor-in-chief of Ebony and Jet Magazine for many, many years, but he passed away on the 14th. And so after the event, he was my original choice to be the theme speaker for this event.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had spoken to him probably about a year ago now, I would guess. And he, at the time, said he would be interested in coming and being involved and being our keynote speaker. And then in June of last year, he was, sort of missing for several days and was found wandering around the city of Chicago and had taken dementia fairly bad. And so it was apparent he wasn't going to be able to come. But when on our statue, Dr. Bennett wrote an article about Dr. Mays, and it was entitled Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, The Last of the Great Schoolmasters, and it was published in Ebony Magazine in December of 1977. And so we put that Last of the Great Schoolmasters quote on the statue.
Oh, cool.
And so after the event, I had sent Joy a whole packet of stuff, you know, pictures, newspaper articles. I mean, it was a thick packet of stuff, and a very nice picture of the plaque that had their father's quote on it. And so she said, you know, she called me Reverend Thomas. She said, Reverend Thomas, when Daddy saw that, she said he just began to cry and weep. And she said that, interestingly enough, he was going through these photos of, like, Dr. Carter and Dr. Moss, and although his memory was, you know, largely gone, he remembered all of them. And so she called me today, in fact, and she was saying that on Saturday, you know, he died Tuesday, and she said on Saturday he wanted to see the picture again, and they went through him again, and she said a tear came to his eye again. He was just, you know, very appreciative, even at that stage of his life, and all that Mays meant to him, and the fact that that article that he, and that statement that he coined is now sort of enshrined with his mentor on the statue here in Greenwood, which is a phenomenal and fabulous thing.
You know, I think it's so interesting that a man such as Benjamin Mays came from, I'm sorry, Greenwood, 96. Right?
No, really. 96 claims him, but you know, he was really from Phoenix, which is sort of near Epworth. It is at the time that would have been old Edgefield County, South Carolina. It's now a part of Greenwood County, South Carolina. So, I mean, he probably was closer to 96 than he was to Greenwood, but really neither of them was he. You know, there was no Greenwood County at the time, and it's really not 96, but...
No, yeah. But, you know, don't you think it's amazing that a man with his humble beginnings was able to rise to be president of the college, and just to have... met with so many people.
An advisor to three presidents.
And, you know, when you think about all of that, what did I see? He had a 90-minute meeting with Gandhi.
With Gandhi, yeah. Yeah, so in 1936, at the time, he was the head of the School of Religion, the dean of the School of Religion at Howard University, and the then president of Howard, Mordecai Johnson, had been going about the country for about a year trying to convince the African-American community to pursue nonviolence as a course of fighting against segregation. He then sent one of Dr. Mays' proteges and a group of people to India about 6 months before Mays goes, and they came back and gave this report. And so when he goes, they tell him that he really needs to go and meet with Gandhi. So 1936, New Year's Eve, he has a chance to have a 90-minute meeting with Mahatma Gandhi in Mysore, India.
I mean, you hear all these stories about him and who he met with and who he influenced. And, you know, it just kind of makes you wonder, would there have been a king if it had not been for Benjamin Mays?
Absolutely not. There wouldn't have been a king. We would not have had a civil rights movement as quickly as we did. You know, Mays was the... orchestrator of you know,
the man behind the scenes.
He was the man behind the scenes. So you know, we sort of King is the Elvis Presley of his time, for lack of a better analogy. But you know, we don't know any of the people that wrote the songs, and so that's, you know, in some ways why Mays sort of walks in the shadows of the great civil rights leaders that he produced. But really, you know, if you listen to any of them, you know, it was the influence of Ben Mays every Tuesday at chapel, telling these young men, one, to hold your head high and to walk through life with dignity and pride and work hard, but also telling them to aspire to higher things, you know, to whatever is possible in life. You know, he believed that they could do it, and he put that belief in them. And concerning civil rights, you know, he taught these young people that, you know, he didn't want to hear them complain about what was wrong in the world. He said, if you want to change something, you want to see something change, you do it. You know, don't sit around murmuring and complaining about what's wrong. And so, you know, he literally...
That's good advice for everybody.
It is great advice for everybody. And so, you know, he was cut from a different cloth and from a different time. You know, it's almost probably unimaginable for people today to even understand, you know, what it would be like to have to go and hear a you know, he was sort of the last dying breed of these clergymen college presidents that forced you to go to chapel and hear him preach once a week. And Mays' influence, not just on men, you know, there were many, many Spelman women who came across the street to hear him every Tuesday, and who he left a lasting impact and legacy upon. Of course, Dorothy Height was probably one of the greatest. You know, she called herself a Mays girl because of the influence that Mays had upon her. And so Mays, you know, his influence on young people was just, you know, wide and vast. And he left, he changed changed the course of American history through this sort of army of young men that he produced through his presidency at Morehouse and even during his first teaching stint, because, you know, his first time that he was there, you know, one of his brightest students was a young man named James Neybert Jr., and later he becomes Dr. James Neybert. But James Neybert leaves Morehouse and goes to law school. I think it was Northwestern University Law School. And he then becomes a law professor at Howard University, and he's on the faculty there when Mays is there as the dean of the School of Religion. And, of course, he becomes the first person, black or white, to teach a course in civil rights law in this country. And, of course, his brightest student at that time, James Neybert, was Thurgood Marshall. And so when Thurgood Marshall,
the connections yes. are just unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Aren't they?
They really are. So, and you know, and so when Thurgood Marshall of course goes later to argue the Brown versus Board of Education case, he reaches back and gets his old college professor, who was a mentee of Mays during his first teaching stint, and the two of them, along with another gentleman, go and argue the three cases that made up the Brown versus Board of Education case. And there's the picture of the three of them, sort of with that grin on their face, standing outside of the Supreme Court when they won that case in 1954. And so, you know, again, Mays's tentacles stretch far and wide.
You know, it kind of makes you wonder. What do you think Dr. Mays would think of the situation we have going today?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, because one of the things that I find is that, you know, since we study so little about this history, I think that we tend to overreact to our current climate as though it's really so bad. I think that Dr. Mays, although he probably would be inclined to buck against things that he didn't like, that was just his way, I think he would clearly say that the times that we're living in don't even rival the Greenwood County of his childhood. You know, so we
You mean the segregation and the separation that was had?
And even just the random acts of violence. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying that I'm, you know, in favor of the instance of police brutality and things like that that occur in our society. But one, they're pale in comparison to even what they would have been 20 years ago. I mean, you know, I would have been much more likely in the 1980s to face harm by police officers than my children would today. But that being said, I live in a world now in Greenwood where I can go to any restaurant I want to. I can walk in the front door. As long as I have a debit card and money, they're going to serve me. They're going to be nice to me. You know, Dr. Mays grew up in a time where, you know, you could be subject to random violence of just citizens. And I'm talking about lynchings. You know, he said his earliest memories in life were as a four-year-old in the Phoenix riots. And you know, and it was at a time where whites in the South were really going about the business of reestablishing white rule in the South, and in South Carolina, it was really almost like a military coup. I mean, you know, it was a takeover of our government. You know, during the Reconstruction time, we were the great world model, I think South Carolina was, of a multiracial democracy. And at the end of the Reconstruction era, whites in the South in this state decided that, you know, that wasn't acceptable. And so before they put in place laws to affect African Americans and how they could move about and roam about, violence was the law of the land. And so, of course, the Phoenix riots was just that. I mean, it was, you know, a period of that week, there were 9 African Americans killed and lynched here in this county. And the violence went on for almost a month. And they say that over 1,000 African American men fled to the woods, never to be seen again. And it wasn't until a month later that, of course, of all people, Ben Tillman comes back to Greenwood after he heard all this discussion up in Washington that they were thinking about sending federal troops down here. And he tells the citizens here, look, you better stop all this violence or the government's going to send someone down here. In addition to that, you're having a labor shortage. All the men you need to work your farms are running to the woods and going somewhere else. And so the violence then stopped. But, you know, it was that kind of, you know, violence from that period, even going up until the 1930s and 40s, that this was the climate that people lived in here in our society. And we don't necessarily want to talk about it, but, you know.
But, you know, you need to remember it.
You do.
And I think that is the problem with our society right now. We don't sit down and we don't teach history
sure.
the way history should be taught.
Absolutely.
Actually, what happened.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
We sugarcoat it, or we take things
sure.
out, and we don't let our kids see. Because they always say, if you don't know where you've been, Yeah. You could end up there again.
And then we demonize, you know, a person like Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump is painted like he's Bull Connor. you know, I mean, if you really go back and look at many of these Southern segregationists, I mean, these were you know, rough guys, you know, and their means of dealing with people that stepped out of line with the Southern segregation and what it meant was through acts of sheer violence and almost re-enslavement. I mean, you know, I had family members of mine that did minor crimes here and spent years on a chain gang. You know, and so for people to say that somehow, you know, we're sort of living in the same kind of times, we're simply not, you know, and that doesn't mean that you have to be happy with everything today. But, you know, don't make statements like Jesse, whatever his name was, that was on I think it was the NAACP Awards that said, you know, that life for a black man in America now is no different than it would have been in 1650 or whatever. I mean, that is an absurd thing to say. And we say things like that, again, because we don't necessarily study the history of the time and period that someone like Benjamin Mays becomes significant. And the fact that Benjamin Mays had to have real courage, because to do the things that he did, he risked life and limb, as did he risk the lives of his family members and people around him, because, you know, you could have been subject at any time to real violence at that time. You know, he had to be someone that was really courageous and audacious to really take on some of the things that he did, as opposed to, you know, sort of Hollywood stars who get, you know, with their million-dollar mansions, you know, get on Facebook.
They just open their mouths and say things and make statements, and now all of a sudden that's the way things are.
Sure, exactly. And so Dr. Mays grew up in a time, and his family grew up in a time that he faced real harsh potential violence and pressure, and he chose to rebel against it. I mean, in a lot of very, very different ways. He refused to go to segregated theaters. He refused to go up segregated elevators. So if someone had a segregated elevator that he had to get on, he'd take the stairs, whether it was 11 flights up. And he really made a life of just, you know, that's why he entitled
us. Lived it by example.
He lived it by example. And
you know, he did what he preached and what he did. He wasn't saying one thing on the one hand and doing something else on the other.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, he was just a different individual when it came to that.
But he was a common everyday man. He was a man that had beliefs and stood for his beliefs.
He was. And another thing I think fascinating about him, Anne, is that, you know, you have all kind of elements that created what became the civil rights movement, some more radical, some more accommodationist. And for as radical as he was for his time, Dr. Mays never believed that America needed to be thrown out. He was a strong proponent of American values. Which is very interesting, saying that he leaves Greenwood County as a 19-year-old, believing that all whites were his enemy because of his experiences here. And so he goes off first to Virginia Union for a year at Richmond, Virginia. And he says that he gets there, and for the first time he finds you know, white professors that were concerned about the Negro student. And these two white professors were both graduates of Bates College in Lewiston, Maine. And Dr. Mays had this vision.
You know, that's where I'm from.
Oh, is it? Okay. That's where Dr. Mays went to college.
Right. I know. I always found that fascinating. Yeah. Because I'll tell you, in truth, we never saw that many black people
in
Maine.
Sure.
I mean, it was a rarity to see somebody that was black.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And you know, I've always been fascinated with how Bates College took this interest in bringing black students to Bates, because they have a long legacy of it. But of course, you know, Mays meets these two professors, and they find out that he has this childhood dream. You know, Mays was always bothered by the idea of black inferiority that existed in the South, that basically said that black people, by virtue of their birth, were inferior, you know, particularly in terms of their mental faculties, to whites. And that always bothered Mays. And he said he once told his saintly mother that if God had made him inferior, he said, "Mama, I could never pray to a God like that." And that vexed his mom, because she kind of thought her son was becoming an atheist or something. But what Mays was really saying is he just didn't believe that God had made him inferior. And he wanted an opportunity to be able to go and prove that. And so he always wanted to go. He had this dream. Never had seen the North, but he always said he wanted to go North, compete with the minds of these Yankees, these, you know, intelligent white Northerners he'd heard so much about. But he just didn't know how to navigate that. And so, you know, kind of, I guess, by divine intervention, he ends up at Virginia Union, and two of these professors are Bates College graduates, and they both write him letters of recommendation. So his sophomore year, he goes to Bates College. And I say that just to say that his life, in terms of how he viewed race, went through this sort of great transformative process. And in fact, while he's at Bates College, he was struggling to, because, he was a student of religion, and in order to really study religion, you know, in terms of the New Testament particularly, you had to be able to master Greek, and he was really struggling with the language, and he then goes to one of his professors and asks him, I really need some help, and so as a part of this help, he had to go and do some work around this professor's house, and so he's out there because he's a Southerner in the blizzard snow, shoveling snow, at a time where no one else is out there because they realize this isn't exactly when you shovel snow, and so this professor comes out and says, what are you doing, Benny? What are you doing? I'm shoveling snow, and get in here, And so this man brings him inside and sits him by the fireplace in his home next to his white teenage daughter, which, he was blown away by that because a Southerner would never do that. But more importantly, that Dr. Mays got frostbite from that episode in the snow. And so for the rest of his life, he had this sort of racial irony in that when it got cold, his hands and feet would tingle. And although it hurt and it bothered him, it was uncomfortable, but it always reminded him of the kindness that this white man had shown him in Lewiston,
Maine. I've never heard that story. Yeah. That's a story I hadn't heard. I knew he went to Bates.
Yes, he did. He did. Yeah. And so he has, many of these sort of interesting intersections where – he experiences, not sort of in a textbook, but in his real life, what I say is sort of the truth about race in America, and that it was multifaceted. It wasn't, everybody racist everywhere. And so he experienced both the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think it gave him really sort of a well-balanced idea of what he thought should happen in America and what race relations should be like. And, and because of that, he just has a sort of rich characterization of what he wanted to see happen. In fact, he thought, or he had hoped, that his beloved Christian church would take lead in desegregating American society. In fact, when he hears about the Brown versus Board of Education case and that they won, he was actually walking through the door of a white couple who were friends of his, and they told him that they had won. And they said that his reaction was kind of unhappy, it seemed, and he said, "No, I'm happy that it happened." He said that, but I had always hoped that it would be my beloved Christian church that would be the one that would take the lead in this, and not the
education.
Well, not the Supreme Court. And so, he had this idea in him. In fact, he believed that if he could bring white and black Christians and clergymen to a place where they preached a balanced view of love and human relations, that by the 1970s, that all Christian church in America would be interracial and not be segregated. In fact, that never happened. It hasn't happened to the day, but that was his hope. I mean, he had great hopes and aspirations for America. And you find that in his students. I mean, one of the things that I find very interesting about King is that, King, although he was radical in many ways, King had the highest hopes for America. It wasn't, like some other elements of the movement that was, burn America, burn. He simply believed that America was this wonderful place that had just made this promise to all of its citizens and hadn't fulfilled it to its black citizens. And in most of his speeches, particularly the I Have a Dream speech, he just said he wanted America to rise up and to live out its promise. And I think he got that from his mentor, because that was Mays's primary position, that he saw the goodness in people by and large, and he wanted to see America rise up to be all that it could be.
Yeah, I think President Trump's speech where he said Americans have dreams too.
Yeah,
I think really kind of, if you really think about it, takes it back to I have a dream. We all have dreams that we would like to fulfill.
Sure.
I mean, whether you own a business, work for somebody else, or trying to get started in this world, we all have dreams, and we all have dreams for our children.
Sure. But Trump's been so demonized by people on the left that just completely, no matter what he did, he could cure cancer. and
there'd
people
be a reason why he couldn't do it.
Sure,
really. Yeah.
Sure. Or
it was fake.
Or he had some sinister motive behind it. He was trying to cure cancer only in Russia or something. He's just very, very disliked by folks
the
on the
media.
Left.
And
our media now is largely run by leftists, and I don't even say Democrats. I'm saying the Democratic Party, and for those of your listeners, I am a lifelong Democrat, and I struggle with my own party because even in my lifetime, it has moved vastly to the left, and in areas that I'm extremely uncomfortable, that I don't agree with the direction and the platform of the party. But I think that's one of the problems, and of course during the last presidency, the last 8 years, the party even swung further to the left, and I don't necessarily know if that was President Obama's desire, because certainly much of what he said when he was running for presidency and what he did weren't, you know,
two entirely different things.
But certainly, you know, I think there was just great pressure in the party. And you know, now it's a party that, that, you know, almost if there weren't some shenanigans, they may have elected a self-avowed socialist to be, the front man for a major political party in America. And that's, you know, says something very serious about American society.
It's really scary.
It absolutely is scary.
I mean, really scary.
Sure. Yeah.
Because we have one vote. Mm-hmm. And the swing of what the media and what political parties and how everything is presented and put out and the timing of everything.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting, you know, with our Mays topic where that's concerned is, you know, Mays was going to be nominated by John Fitzgerald Kennedy to be a United States ambassador. And two Georgia senators, who of course at that time they were Democrats, put forth this idea and this notion out there that Ben Mays was a communist. And so because of that, you know, Kennedy ends up, of course, withdrawing. Yeah. And so, but it's just interesting to me that, you know, communism and socialism are sort of in the same vein.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, at that time, Dr. Mays couldn't even be, have his name put forth to be a United States ambassador because he, quote, might be a communist. Fast forward, you know, 50 years or more, and you have a major party that's willing to elect someone that says he's a democratic socialist, whatever that means. You know, it's just very, very interesting how times change in a society, in a culture, about what we think is okay and acceptable. And, you know, being a communist 50, 60 years ago was a dirty word, as would have been a socialist.
Absolutely. Well, this is quite an interesting conversation we're having here this afternoon, Chris Thomas.
It is.
And it's all based on the fact that you are going to start a program here in Greenwood, Let's Talk Race. And when we come back, we're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk about this program that actually starts this Sunday, and it's going to be at the Benjamin Mays Center. And I think you're doing the talking, aren't you?
I'm going to introduce the program, and then Loy Sarton's going to do, and I'm going to introduce it sort of based upon this. Dr. Mays in 1946 wrote a small pamphlet entitled Seeking to Be Christian in Race Relations. And so I'm going to sort of introduce the discussion around this, and then Loy Sarton is going to do a discussion about a presentation about Mays, and then we're going to have a discussion. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we'll be right back. Don't you go away. Hey, if you got a question or a comment, give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
It's so important to make someone happy. Make just one someone happy.
And hey, gals, there's nothing like showing a little love and sharing a little love. How about a pocket watch for that hard-to-shop-for guy? They're all 40% off right now. You can buy one working condition, good-looking pocket watch, whether he wears it, uses it, or just sets it on his desk as a memento that time is ticking and our love is great.
Make just one someone happy. And you will be happy too.
Make him happy. Check online at theantiquevintageremporium.com or call us 229-6613 or just stop by 637 Durst Avenue East. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm having a fascinating conversation here this afternoon with Chris Thomas. He is the director of the Benjamin Mays Center over there on Hospital Street.
Yep.
Is it 237?
Yep.
What, 237 yes. Hospital Street? It's the same place where the Gleams Center is. And I tell you what, you're right. Loy did an awesome job. I was very involved in it, of it coming together and the opening ceremony that they had. He was the one that made sure we even had cotton out there.
Yeah,
a field of cotton,
sure.
So you could get the whole feel of it. And I must admit, I have not been back probably in the last couple of years,
okay.
But I need to come out there and see what has changed and what has been even more awesomeness been done.
Yeah. I mean, at least come to see the statue. It is a beautiful.
I have seen the statue.
Oh, you have seen. Okay.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful, beautiful addition to our site.
I mean, it is, and it certainly has become one of the places when you bring people to town that you need to make sure that they see this and realize the contributions that came out of our area.
Absolutely.
To race relations and the King's time would not have been as great if it hadn't been for the influence that Benjamin Mays had had over him.
I mean, you know, again, what would it even have been at all? I mean, you know, one of the things that benefited both King and a lot of these young men is, you know, when Dr. Mays comes to Morehouse in 1940, you know, the following year, 41, war breaks out. The college is already in some financial trouble when he got there, but of course, losing 60% of your students makes it worse. And so one of the things that he does is he starts this early admissions program. And it was actually from some money that was coming from the foundation. I'll think of it in a second.
Okay.
And they were basically giving this money because they wanted these young people to go to college early in hopes that they would graduate before they got drafted into the war. And so Mays goes and gets some of this money to start an early admissions program at Morehouse. And so 1944 is the first class of these young men that come in is 14 and 15 year olds. And of course, King comes to Morehouse early. So, you know, King graduates from college at 18. And so that was, you know, one of these sort of, you know, babies of Mays that, that he created. And of course, you know, King would have not been influenced. And also, you know, he comes to Morehouse and he sees Benjamin E. Mays. He originally wanted to study sociology and go into law and become a lawyer. He had no intention of being a clergyman, and it was under the leadership of Mays that he just makes the decision to enter the ministry. And so, you know, certainly many of those decisions were influenced by Mays. So certainly if it wasn't for Dr. Mays, there would not have been a Martin Luther King Jr.
Absolutely. Well, this program that is going to be going on is actually going to be going on over the next 3 months.
It will be, yeah.
Yes, and it kicks off this coming Sunday, the 18th at 2 p.m. One of the things that I think was very smart, I'll just tell you, having all these events on Sunday.
That wasn't my idea, so that was Prudence's idea, our librarian.
Right.
And so she was the one, you know, because she's been hosting many of these events at the library for a long time. They have these Sunday afternoon events.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she and Dr. Daniel Harrison and some others that are on a committee, you know, got together month and a half, 2 months ago, and started talking about ideas about putting this program on. And I think it was a collaboration of many people to put this together. And it's going to be a wonderful, you know, 3 months of events. There's even an event.
Sunday afternoon is a good time, is what I'm saying. If you go to church and
sure.
have lunch and
yep.
then go do mm-hmm. something like
yeah.
this,
yeah.
it doesn't conflict with so
it,
many other
it doesn't.
Things going
it doesn't.
On.
Yeah. And so we're excited about all the events. I think they're going to be wonderful.
So tell us what this whole program is about.
So the program is about creating spaces and opportunities for dialogue around the issue of race. You know, there's been a lot of great work on, you know, dialogue for social change, largely among academics, but I think that there's some practical applications for it that, you know, we sometimes don't talk about issues, whether it's race or whether it's, you know, the Me Too movement or whatever it is, you know, people just, and one thing that I find about the race issue is that, you know, people throw the term out there, racist or racism, and people on both sides of the spectrum of that argument oftentimes aren't even talking about the same thing, you know, so people will say, you know, Donald Trump's a racist, and then people on the right will say, no, he's not, because their concept of what a racist is isn't even, so they're not even talking about the same thing.
I want to interject just
sure.
a little story that is
okay.
just going to set this off. One of our customers, a very nice black lady, was sitting in there talking to us, and I happened to show her a ring that was yellow gold that I thought she would like.
Uh-huh.
And she told me, oh no, Ann, I only wear white gold. And I said, well, you are a racist. When you talk about and for a minute she looked at me
sure.
like, what are you talking about, Ann? And then she realized what I was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, yeah.
And that's the same type
of
thing.
And it is. And so we, you know, and people just throw terms out there as though all of us, you know, are talking about the same thing. And many times we're not. You know, what Ann's definition of racist might be and what my definition of racist might be could be, you know,
yards
100
apart.
Miles apart, yeah. And so, but we'll sit there and have an argument with each other and think we're talking about the same thing. And in fact, we're not. And so
correct.
I think that people need to have discussions about, you know, what exactly, you know, race is and racism is. I mean, for gosh sake, we can't even come to grips, you know, well over 100 years, you know, 150 years after the Civil War, asked even the cause of the war. and so, you know, I think that that lets me know there needs to be continued dialogue and discussion about the subject of race in America, what it has meant historically, what it means now. Because I think that, you know, people need to come to some common grounds about something. And the one thing that I want people to come to common grounds about the fact is, irrespective of where you think that, you know, there's racism in society now or there's not, we all have to come to a place where we all sit down and say, man, America has improved greatly. You know, the fact that we can't even really come, you know, to that place, it's problematic, because, you know, certainly people have to have an understanding that, you know, race relations in America have improved, even though they might not be what everybody wants them to be.
Sure.
They've improved vastly. I don't live in my grandfather's America. I mean, you know, I don't, my grandfather was afraid when I was a teenager, you know, me driving through certain neighborhoods around here. You know, I don't worry about my kids driving through a neighborhood in Greenwood. I mean, you know, in terms of worrying about, you know, they're going to be drug out of their car by the Klan, or, you know, I mean, sure. I don't have those concerns. And so, and I don't think many African Americans that are any that live, you know, that have rational thoughts, that live in this community or any community, have those kinds of concerns. And so we, you know, we live in a society that's changed. Now, we can have a discussion about, you know, where we need to go from here, but I think there are some areas that we need to come to a general agreement about the issue of race in America. And so, you know, these, all of these events are going to serve as a dialogue and a dialogue and a discussion, and also a look back at what race has historically meant, you know, in our society, by folks like James Baldwin. You know, what was Baldwin's view of it in the 60s and 50s, and so, you know, and why was his view of it what it was? And I think that we just need to come to a place where we can have a dialogue about it, because right now, a lot of us, quite honestly, are very uncomfortable talking about the subject, particularly people that are on different spectrums of the political sphere. You know,
Senator Tim Scott.
Uh-huh.
Was in Washington, and he, one of the things that he says, that here he is a senator, and he still got stopped,
sure,
for driving where quote he shouldn't be.
Yeah. Sure.
And I think one of the other things Tim Scott, Senator Tim Scott, and Trey Gowdy came up with was their have Sunday lunch with somebody you don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. So that you can actually begin to have a conversation and see the things that are the same, mm-hmm, and yeah, the things that are the different. And what you might find is there are more things that are the same, mm-hmm, than there are the differences. Yeah. And maybe if you just have conversation, which seems to be something that's lacking in Washington, D.C.,
sure,
be able to sit down and talk.
Yeah.
And be able to be free about what you're talking about. You know, to be able to say what it is you want to say.
Yeah.
Without recriminations that you've said it, sure, and so the other person can respond.
Sure. And that's one of the things that I want to do, and the things, these events that I'm facilitating, is that, you know, oftentimes people on whichever side, particularly people that are more on the right in this subject, often feel nervous or concerned about expressing their own views about race in America, because it's not the line that we often toe about the discussion, particularly in academic circles. And so I think that they should be, you know, free to come and express. You have people that think that we live in completely post-racial America and there are no racial issues. And, you know, I don't agree with that, but certainly I think you should be able to come and sit down and have a conversation, express your views, why you feel that way, because I think there may be some legitimate reasons why people feel that way, because I think for some people, race is not an issue. And even for some African-American people, I think, you know, if you're someone that is just at a very, very early age endowed with great talents and gifts and abilities, and, you know, you can go through life almost like none of it ever affects you. And that person,
right,
if that's that person's experience is valid, is as valid as mine. And I think that they should be able to, you know, people on my side, or I say that because, you know, I'm more Democratic, on the left side typically want to shut Tim Scott down, or anybody that claims to be, you know, a Republican or a conservative and is African American. And I've been saying for a long time that I think it's very problematic to the black community, particularly when you look at the fact that we're getting into politics now, but that either party is only in power half the time. And so if you put all of your eggs as a community into one basket, you know, particularly when, quite honestly, where social issues are concerned, and even for more affluent African Americans, where financial issues are concerned, we are one of the most conservative groups of people in this country. You know,
yes.
And that was a lot of the black community's angst with Obama, that, you know, he really went against many of our long-held, you know, beliefs and ideas in black America, and we weren't really to criticize him because we didn't want to criticize the first black president, but you know, at the barbershop and at our kitchen tables, you know, there was a whole other discussion going on about some of the directions that the Democratic Party was taking us. And so I think that I'm always been, you know, very uncomfortable with the fact that there is a long, rich legacy of black conservatism, but that legacy is often thrown out, you know, in our community, and I think it needs to be looked at and examined, because you know, some of those policies may be good for us. You know, I argued when John McCain was running for presidency, I thought John McCain had one of the best ideas that anybody's ever had about fixing black America. That John McCain said that, you know, one of the problems we had is that there were not enough African-American school teachers, male school teachers. And so he said there's all these men that might not have degrees, but they're graduated, but they've had long military careers. You know, we should give them a path to teacher certification. Doesn't require them to go back and spend $40,000 and get a degree. If that would have happened, it would have radically changed the outcome for African American men in particular in public schools.
You know what's a bad thing about that is that you're right. That's a great idea.
Absolutely.
And yet it's never been picked up on.
No. Well, you know,
because it was McCain's idea.
If you shoot the messenger, he can't bring you the message. And so I think that oftentimes, you know, there are ideas on the right of the political spectrum that are could be a great benefit to African Americans. But again, we tend to, as a community that's leaned more politically towards accepting the friendship and the political coming together of the leftist community, that, you know, that's almost like, you know, an abomination.
Let's just take the President Trump's State of the Union speech.
Sure.
And I thought, here you have black unemployment is lower than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And nobody sitting that was a Democrat could even say hallelujah or that's good or sure. anything along that line. That's sad. That is very sad.
And again, I think it's because that we have accepted a lot of, you know, ideas and ideologies that sometimes just lack common sense. I mean, I argued, you know, and again, I sometimes people think I sound like a Republican, but you know, I argued some time ago that, you know, a $15 minimum wage is the kith of death for teenage black people. So, sure. You know, for my teenage sons that are trying to get their first job, if the minimum wage is $15 an hour, when typically even today we are, you know, our young people are the last to be hired, the first to be fired, if there's a $15 minimum wage, the last person that's going to get a job is the young African-American man who's going out looking for his first job, because that's just the reality of it. So you know, these policies might sound great, you know, a living wage, but you know, I mean, I feel like, you know, if my son is 15 and he needs a job, even if it's $8 an hour or $6 an hour or $5, you know, you go get a job.
Yeah.
But again,
my first job, I made 50 cents an hour.
Yeah. Now, I mean, yeah. I feel for the you know, the minimum wage person at $5 an hour that's now a 25-year-old mother of four. You know, that's a sort of a different scenario.
Right.
Yeah. But I think that if, you know, from an African American community standpoint, if you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, we're going to suffer. And you know, those are the kinds of things, again, that, you know, it's like heresy for me to even say that, particularly on the radio, but it's just the truth of it.
Well, you said it, and
I say it all the time. but you know, these are some of the kinds of things that I think that we need to come around to as a community to say that, you know, all ideas that are being put forth by Republicans
should
be considered. Yeah, because
we should sit down and talk about it.
Sit down and talk about it. And the same is true for what we're talking about here, the race issue. Something we should sit down and have a discussion about. And so, you know, we want to create both some of the movies, some of the books we're going to read are going to focus around the historical issue of race, and have an opportunity once we watch these movies or read these books to sit down and have a discussion about them. And I'm really hoping that people from a wide spectrum of our community will come out and have these discussions, because, again, you know, racism and race to me is like, you know, if anyone's ever had a wound that didn't heal very well because there was still something festering under your skin, and on the surface it just looks like it's great, but the person just keeps scratching and down beneath there's something really bad's going on. And that's kind of the way we are oftentimes. You know, we will say hi and smile, and you know, but ultimately we have what's said at the kitchen table in your home about race and what's said in the kitchen table in my home about race are two completely different things. And we need to come together and have sort of a meeting of the minds where that's concerned.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that you brought up about Benjamin Mays and church, it is amazing, though, the differences in churches mm-hmm. between a black church and a white church.
Sure. Yeah.
They're very, very different. And Beth Bethel wrote a book about Promised Land.
Yeah, we saw it at the site.
Yes, yeah. And of course, she talked about being the first white woman to go down to the, what's the church in Promised Land that she went to, and it took months for her to be accepted into the church.
Yeah.
But when she was, and she wrote a book, of course, about the history and everything of Promised Land.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful book, too.
Is a wonderful book.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the big questions to ask today, you know, as it relates to race. You know, we've gone through legal segregation, or integration, excuse me, in America. But are we really integrated as a society?
That's a good question.
You know, and I really, and I don't blame one side or the other, because even myself, you know, I can't really say of a white friend that I have. I mean, you know, when you have a job, you have, you know, people that you work with. I'm talking about someone that you, on a Saturday in the evening, that you make a date to go out to dinner with, you know. And I would think that for the most of us, you know, I mean, even go around Greenwood or any community and look at, you know, people that are sitting down having dinner together, you don't generally see a lot of interracial groups of people having that kinds of interactions together. And of course, you know, church in America is still, you know, King said it, but of course, that was one of the sayings he borrowed from Mays. Mays said it long before King said it, that 11 a.m. on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. And I think that's still by and large true. And so you see some integrated churches today, but by and large, there are churches with white leaders that African Americans come and attend. That's not necessarily a two-way street. You don't have many African American pastors or African American led churches that you get whites to come and attend.
That's another issue.
It's another issue, you know.
Yeah,
and so
issue.
You know, how segregated or how integrated are we really in 2018? And I would say that we're more integrated in that, you know, we're integrated economically, meaning that if I can afford a house in Hunter's Creek or in Gatewood, you know, I can go buy it.
Right.
but will my children ultimately become, you know, intimate friends? I mean, real friends with their.
Well, except, Chris, you look at the dating situation today.
That's
true. We're seeing lots of black-white couples.
You are seeing that more and more.
Married couples.
Yeah.
So I think, and is it because, and is that just a function of age? Meaning younger people see it, looking at it differently than adult people.
I think that is true. Younger people have a very, very different perspective on race than later generations. I think the challenge of race with younger people is really more class related than it is race related. So two people that typically live in the same social class don't necessarily see race as an obstacle, as opposed to two people that are of different racial groups that come from different social backgrounds. And so I think that there is sort of a changing idea, you know, where that's concerned. But those kinds of things exist in enclaves, and meaning that, you know, the people that do that are still aware that, you know, I can drive from one community to another, and the same vibe that I get in my home community, that's okay with it. You get a different vibe if you drive, you know, to another community. So I think there are certainly some changes that are happening there. And the interesting thing with, you know, interracial relations between blacks and whites is, for a long time, it was primarily African-American men that were marrying and dating white women. Now that's flipped. you know, the by and large, particularly of women that are in a higher education and social class, you're seeing, you know, lots of African-American women that are dating and marrying white men. And I'm not saying something wrong with it. I'm saying that's just
it's sad that you have to say, saying there's something wrong about it.
Yeah. Well, because people get the sense that you're defending or attacking,
right.
I'm just simply saying that that's, you know, sort of what's happening in our society. You know, but it's not necessarily a new phenomenon. I mean, interracial marriage and dating has always existed in American society. That's why.
But not to the outcome, maybe, that we're having today. There was a lot of angst against it.
In some ways, yay. In some ways, it depends on where you were. And of course, you know, in Southern society, it was largely, you know.
In the football society, football, major football players and things like that, that it was okay.
Yeah. Well, I think part of that happens because, you know, years ago, you know, I was a college athlete, and certainly I leave a more urban environment and go to this, you know, 98% white school, you know, and you're a young man at your dating age, and you know, around you, you know, on campus, is there's, you know, 300 African American male athletes, or 400 or 500, depending on how large a school it is, and you know, there's 20 women to choose from, black women. And so...
So the picking was good.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reality is that, you know, you're going to look around and, you know, there's not enough African-American women for all the African-American men to date. So obviously dating white women is going to be, you know, and particularly if you're somewhere where there's no... social angst about it, you know, you're just at an age where you're dating. And quite honestly, you know, race is a social construct that was created. You know, there really is, I don't think there really is a race of people. And so, you know, if you see a man that you think's attractive, whether he's black, brown, or vice versa, a man sees a woman, you know, take away all the social taboos and people are just going to date who they're attracted to. And I think that that's, you know, happens in many places. I think it's happening in society now. If people don't have to live in an environment where there's any social stigma attached to it, then people are going to date who they're attracted to and who they like. And that for an African-American man could be a white woman or a Chinese woman, or for a white woman, it could be an African-American man or a Chinese man. And so I think that, you know, people are, and people probably would have done this years ago, but there was just a lot of social stigma and social pressure that would have prevented that from happening. And I'll tell you a funny, funny story.
This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Take a breath. All right. And tell me one more story here.
So I had a group of ladies over at the May site one day, and they were all older, and I won't tell the group organization, but they were all older ladies in their 80s and 90s. And so I was doing a tour in the May site, and one of the ladies was in her 90s, had to go to the restroom, and so someone went and helped her. And she comes out of the restroom, and I'm doing my tour, and so I'm, you know, talking, going around the room, pointing to pictures and stuff, and her and the lady that came out of the restroom with her were just cracking up. They were laughing, you know. And so the lady that organized this, you know, finally interrupted and said, "Would you all stop? You know, you're being rude to Mr. Thomas." And the lady said, I won't say her name, she said, "Well, all I said was is that I'm, you know, 94 years old, and I've never," it's kind of a crass joke, there was a picture of Dr. Mays in the restroom. And she basically said that she'd never exposed herself in front of a Negro man before.
Yes.
You know, and everybody just cracked up. You know, it was just funny because of her age, and, you know, and then and then she said, well, the other lady said, "Well, that really wasn't funny. What was funny is that she said that she didn't mind because he was a good looking Negro man." And then, but the point I'm making is that this older lady in her 90s, she kind of stopped and had this sort of gazing back over her life look, and she said, "Yeah, because Papa wouldn't have let me." And it was just a profound moment for me to realize that this woman, you know, she basically made us very aware of the social constraints that would have been on her as a young woman, even had she wanted to, that she just simply could not have, at least not without being, you know, sort of expelled out of the South and sent to the North somewhere.
Right.
And so these are the kinds of, you know, racial constrictions that people faced in those days, particularly as it related to interracial dating and marriage and those kinds of things. You know, another story, I don't know how much time we have, but, you know, one of the things that Dr. Mays does, interestingly, as during his tenure as the president of Morehouse, you know, when he's having these war problems and losing so many students, and he needs to raise money for the college. And he reaches out to just an uncommon person that you would think he would reach out to, but he reached out to Margaret Mitchell, who was the author of Gone with the Wind.
Right.
She was, at that time, a woman that was not very well liked within the African-American community because people thought that her, you know, of course, her father was an ex-Confederate soldier and some of his pictures were plastered on Klan memorabilia. And in addition to that, she is viewed as this woman that created this literary work that had all these racial caricatures in it. And so she wasn't very well liked by the...
Know nothing about birth and no babies.
Yeah.
There you go. Sorry, okay. Go ahead.
And so, you know, he reaches out to her and he writes her this letter and asks her would she consider making a contribution to the college. And so she writes him back and says because of the uncertainties of time, she was talking about the war, she couldn't guarantee that she could make a contribution. And so her husband writes Dr. Mays a letter back and basically says, you know, I would appreciate it if any future correspondence to Miss Mitchell come to me. And she... Essentially, what he was saying is, I don't think this black man should be writing my wife a letter. And so she writes him back, though, and she told him that he was free to communicate with her, but she wanted these correspondence between them to be kept secret. And in fact, over a 13-year period, the two of them correspond back and forth, and she's accredited with sending more than 40 African-American males to either medical or dental school in the state of Georgia. And she radically transforms and changes the medical profession for African-Americans in that state. But the point
well,
that I'm making...
the same plight that women had.
Yeah. But the point I'm making is that Margaret Mitchell understood very well the peril, not just to her, but more so to Ben Mays, if it had been made aware that he was communicating
with
this white woman, you know, and particularly a white woman of her social standing.
Right.
Yeah, and so I think that that was just the nature of society then. And but you know, the fact that the two of them were sort of willing to reach across this unwritten taboo social line in Atlanta, Georgia at the time.
An aisle, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, probably more like a river. that people just did not cross. But Dr. Maines, saw both the necessity of it, and I think that, again, as I said earlier, he saw the inherent goodness in all people, and he thought that we all lived in a world, and that the scripture, the Bible, demanded us to live at peace with one another. And so, he sought to do that in his life in every way. And in fact, no one ever even knows that this is going on. It's not until they're both dead that people find out that the two of them have been corresponding, and that she'd made all these contributions. And of course, he didn't keep any of the letters. It was actually the Margaret Mitchell papers where these letters were discovered years after she was deceased and after Dr. Mace had died. And it's just a phenomenal story. I think it is a beautiful story about, two people that saw some sense of necessity for harmony in race relations, even in the Old South. And they achieved it, in many ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been a fun afternoon.
It has been. I've enjoyed myself.
Absolutely. We'll have to have you back again and talk some more.
We would love to come.
Quickly, let's just go through, because I know you've got someplace to go. You had to squeeze this in with me this afternoon. Aren't you glad you did?
I am glad I did. I'm glad I did.
It's coming up this Sunday, the 18th, 2 p.m., Dr. Benjamin E. May's presentation. Chris is going to be introducing Loy Sartain. Loy Sartain, the museum, the May's site was his baby.
Yeah.
And he's going to talk about that. Let go through real quick some of the other things.
Dr. Harrison will also be there from Lander to sort of facilitate. He's a sociology professor there. Will be there to facilitate a discussion about race and that as well. But on Sunday, March 4th, we're going to have the talk, Race in America. It will be at the Greenwood County Library. And so that should be another wonderful event to come and attend. On Sunday, March...
That's a movie.
It is a movie. Yeah, some of these are movies, so that you'll watch the movie. Then after the movie, you'll have, and we're going to have popcorn and some refreshments and stuff. But after the movie, you'll talk about what the movie was about. And that's one of the beautiful things, I think, and why I know we're out of time, but I'm often saddened that there's not more exposure to, like, the literature of the Harlem Renaissance and sort of the racial literature in America, because I think it is sort of an art introduction to a difficult subject that allows you to sort of talk about that subject through the eyes of an artist that's not as confrontational as you and I.
Think about jazz.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, think about the blues.
Yep. And that's why we're having a jazz concert as a part of this.
Go ahead.
Sunday, March 18th at 2 p.m., The Dream Keeper and Other Poems. So this is going to be, and these books will be available like 2 weeks before each of these events if you want to pick them up at the library. And so this will be reading some Langston Hughes poetry. If any of you have never been exposed to Hughes, he was a magnificent mind, and he sort of communicated the magnificence of his mind through his literary works, and I think that you will appreciate what he says and how he views race and the racial problem in America in his time. On Sunday, April the 8th, it'll be another movie, I Am Not Your Negro, and it will also be at the library, at the county library, and both those events will both be at the county library, and so again, it'll be another opportunity to watch a movie and have a great discussion about race. On Sunday, April 22nd, The Good Lord Bird is another literary work that we will be reading and discussing at the library. Sunday, April the 29th, the Robert Garner Jazz Ensemble. Dr. Garner is a professor of music at Lander, and he also has a jazz
ensemble.
He is awesome. And so we're going to, as you said a minute ago, are going to talk about how jazz music sort of transcended, the racial issue, how it had its influence on places like Harlem at night, even though it was illegal most places, same thing with down in Louisiana, that these black and white artists and blacks and white people would get together and they would dance together and enjoy the music. And so it was just an interesting way that artists were able to communicate a message to a group of people that allowed those people to sort of transcend the world that they lived in, that they would hear that music and they would sit, they would experience it, and suddenly all of the constraints about race that were in their lives for those brief moments just went away. And so it's just a beautiful way to look at race. Sunday, May the 6th at 2, and all these events will be at 2 p.m. except for the Robert Garner event's going to be actually at the Atlanta University at the Josephine B. Abney Sydney Cultural Center. It will be at 7 p.m., that event. It will be on a Sunday, but it will be later in the evening. And then on May the 6th, Slavery by Another Name will be another movie that will be at the Greenwood County Library. And after the movie's over, it'll be followed by a discussion. And then on Sunday, May the 20th at 2 p.m., another novel that we're going to read and sit down and discuss, entitled Four Spirits. It's about the bombing of the church in Birmingham, Alabama. And so the four spirits, of course, are the four little girls. But the event kind of, the book really sort of talks about not just those four little girls, but how this event impacted the whole of the community there in Birmingham. But and we don't have a date for it yet, but as a part of this, there's also going to be a book giveaway. We're going to be giving away nearly 500 books. Some of them will be Mays's books. Some of them will be other titles. The events will take place at two different locations. We tried to pick a predominantly white church, a predominantly black church, and so the younger children will have an event at the Catholic church, and then the older kids will be giving away books of Born to Rebel, hopefully to prompt a summer reading program, and that event will happen at Furman Miller's church there on East Cambridge. I don't know why I can't think of the name of it right now. Forgive me, Furman, Reverend Miller.
I know what it is. I don't know what the name of it is.
I don't know why I can't think of the name. Like, I went there as a child. It was my grandfather's church. But the other event will be there. We're excited about that. And one of the events, we're going to have a sort of Geechee Gullah storyteller that's supposed to come. And we're really excited about this program.
There's more to come. And this is a great start. I certainly hope that you will consider, if not all the events, some of the events, yes, to get out there, yeah, and be able to have a discussion and see what other people think.
Absolutely.
And maybe if we all try to sit down and talk about it like I do and you do, sure, every day,
yep,
maybe we can come to some conclusions.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. I do appreciate you having me. I've really enjoyed myself, and hopefully I'll get a comeback sometime.
Absolutely. That was great, Chris. Hey, you know, you're listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. I'm Ann Eller. My very special guest today was Chris Thomas. He is the director of the Benjamin E. Mays Center over there on Hospital Street. That's going to do it for us. Make sure you look for, I know there was an article in the paper today, Let's Talk About Race in America. I know it's on Facebook, and I know it's also on the library Facebook page and website. Check it out. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
This is it. Bye-bye, everybody.